Radio Prague News.
President Miloš Zeman has not made any final decision concerning the replacement of Culture Minister Antonín Staněk. Two Czech MEPs, Dita Charanzová and Marcel Kolaja, have been elected deputy chairpersons of the European Parliament, and the traditional pilgrimage festival marking the legacy of Saints Cyril and Methodius gets underway at Velehrad in South Moravia. President Miloš Zeman has not made any final decision concerning the replacement of Culture Minister Antonín Staněk, Prime Minister Andrej Babiš said after a meeting at Lány Chateau on Thursday. Mr. Babiš and Deputy Prime Minister Jan Hamáček met with the head of state with the aim to resolve the dispute that could bring down the government. Mr. Hamáček, leader of the Social Democrats, has threatened to walk out of the ruling coalition unless the president complies with his party's request to remove Antonín Staněk from the post of Culture Minister and replace him with the party's nominee Michal Šmarda. The president has so far refused to do so, despite the fact that the prime minister officially requested the minister's dismissal over a month ago. While Mr. Babiš repeated that he would seek a compromise in the dispute in order to preserve the ruling coalition, Mr. Hamáček said he would call a special meeting of the party leadership on the 15th of July to discuss the party's possible exit from the government. Meanwhile, the president said he would meet with Mr. Hamáček and the culture minister on the 12th of July to try to reconcile them. Two Czech MEPs have been elected deputy chairpersons of the European Parliament. Dita Charanzová of the ANO party is a member of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe political group. Before being elected to the European Parliament in 2014, as an independent, she worked in the Czech diplomatic service for over a decade. In the past election term, she was a deputy chairwoman of the Committee on the Internal Market and Consumer Protection. Marcel Kolaja is a newcomer to the European Parliament, serving as an MEP for the Pirate Party since the 2019 election. Mr. Kolaja, who is 39, is a computer expert working with free software and the copyright and is a member of the Greens group. This year's grain harvest is expected to be 8.5% higher than that of the previous year, according to a projected estimate by the Czech Statistics Office released on Thursday. While the yield of grains is expected to reach over 7 million tons, the harvest of rapeseed, the second most frequently sown crop, will be about 12% lower than last year's due to the decrease of the planted area. The traditional pilgrimage festival marking the legacy of Saints Cyril and Methodius, Greek missionaries who brought Christianity to the Czech lands, gets underway at Velehrad in South Moravia on Thursday. The event, called the People of Goodwill Days, includes a number of cultural events, lectures, and is traditionally attended by tens of thousands of believers. The celebrations will be launched in the evening with a charity concert and will culminate on Friday with a national pilgrimage and a celebratory mass. US studio Stephen Hall Architects has won an international architectural and urbanistic competition for a concert hall in Ostrava, the city's mayor Zdeněk Macura announced on Thursday. The cost of the building, which is to be located in the city centre, is estimated at 1.5 billion crowns. The construction works should begin in 2022 and should be completed by the end of 2023. The winning proposal was supported by 6 out of 7 members of the jury. The Czech Weather Office has extended a fire warning to the whole of the Czech Republic in reaction to especially dry conditions in the coming days. In line with the warning, people should refrain from building campfires, smoking or heating meals on portable cookers out in the open. According to the weekly weather forecast, there should only be scattered showers in the coming days, with daytime temperatures hovering around 25 degrees Celsius. The fire warning has been issued for an indefinite period for all of the country's regions. Friday is expected to be partly cloudy, with daytime highs ranging between 23 and 27 degrees Celsius. I'm Ruth Franková, and that's the end of the news.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, the Czech Republic has two vice presidents in the European Parliament. But has the Czech strategy at the EU talks on a division of the alliance's top posts served its best interests? The Czech Republic hopes to win a UNESCO listing for its Krušné hory mining sites, and later on we'll hear from a child survivor of the Holocaust who has fulfilled her dream to build a memorial to the 1.5 million children who were killed. All that coming up, so please stay with us. The European Parliament elected its leadership on Wednesday, and two Czech MEPs, Dita Charanzová from the Liberals group and Marcel Kolaja from the Greens, were elected vice president. I asked Libor Oček himself, a former vice president of the European Parliament, whether he considers this a significant success for a country the size of the Czech Republic.
I think it is, because if we take into account that we have one president and 14 vice presidents, you know, overall 751 members of the parliament. So to have a two vice president, I think it is a success.
Much has been said about the Visegrad Group's strategy at the EU summit this week. The Czech Republic and its allies achieved their goal in sidelining the Spitzenkandidaten, but it was criticized for lacking a positive agenda and for not backing its own candidate. Has the region served its own best interests?
I don't think that it did. Because as you said, the Visegrad Four, and it's not the case, it wasn't the case only at this summit, but we can say that in general, overall, the Visegrad Four group doesn't have any strategy, doesn't bring any constructive, positive proposals. And at the summit, we could see for 30 hours, the Visegrad 4 group was just blocking the Spitzenkandidat. It didn't come with any positive proposal. And the result is that the so-called new member states, the Central and East European post-communist states, have no representation in those four or five top positions in the EU at all.
Yes, there has been criticism of the fact that there is no geographical balance. Why was that?
I think it was because of the attitude of the Visegrad Group. Because in the first proposal, there was a place for a representative of Eastern Europe, for the Bulgarian lady Georgieva.
The Czech Republic and others have been calling for EU reform. Do you feel that the new leadership will open the door to reform?
I think it will be the case, because all four or five representatives, they want more Europe. Some of them are European federalists. They understand the global problems, you know, the impact on the European state. But what I'm not sure is, what the Visegrad 4 members want, or what some other East European countries want, because that's not the type of reform, you know, they envisage or they have in mind.
Have the European elections and the division of top posts, assuming they will stay as proposed, have they strengthened the position of the Czech Republic in the European Union?
I don't think so. As I said, yes, it is a success. And it's good for, I think, not only for the Czech Republic, but for the anti-European parliament, that the parliament will have two Czech vice presidents. Now, both of them, they are sensible, you know, good, honest people. But when we take into account the, you know, the position of the Czech Republic or the Visegrad 4 group in general, so I'm afraid that by this sort of obstructive tactics, or however to call it, you know, the Czech Republic and the Visegrad group will isolate itself even more. Because it's not only this issue, there are other issues. If we take, I don't know, for instance, the climate change and the energy policy, it is again the Visegrad 4 group that tries to block every proposal that's going in the direction of towards greener energy. Look at the refugee issues. I think we should have also common asylum policy, which also the Visegrad 4 countries don't want. So it's not only, you know, one issue. There are more issues where the Visegrad 4 countries differ from the rest of Europe.
Former Vice President of the European Parliament, Libor Rouček, there. Moving on now, a Czech delegation is heading to Baku, Azerbaijan on Monday to lobby for including parts of the Krušnohoří mining region on the UNESCO World Heritage Site listing. It has been 16 years since the Czech Republic added a site to the list. So, what makes the region so special? Brian Kennedy explains.
The Ore Mountains have formed a natural border between Bohemia and the German state of Saxony for some 800 years. Known in Czech as Krušné hory, the uniquely preserved landscape is also among the most heavily researched mountain ranges in the world. In total, the Czech delegation to Azerbaijan has nominated 5 sites in this country for inclusion on the UNESCO World Heritage Site list. A German delegation, with which it submitted a joint bid, has nominated 17 sites on their side of the border. Mikhail Urban of the non-profit mountain region Krušné hory Erzgebirge, formed to coordinate public and private regional groups in hopes of getting the listing, explains how it would help the region.
Inclusion on the UNESCO list would mean more prestige on the international and national levels and could boost tourism. Also, it should strengthen the regional identity and make people living in the Ore Mountains even prouder of the region.
Ore mining in the Krušnohoří region dates back to the 12th century. The area was exceptionally rich in silver, tin, and cobalt. It was also the leading producer of the world's silver during the 15th and 16th centuries, and the boom spawned towns steeped in mining history. It was Saxony that first proposed nominating selected mining sites for the UNESCO list, already back in 1998. Preparations for a joint Czech-German nomination began in 2011, and their first bid was submitted a few years later, recalled Dita Limová, head of the UNESCO division at the Ministry of Culture, in an earlier interview.
We first submitted the nomination in 2014, but we were recommended to rewrite the application. It is a symbolic nomination that binds the German and Czech sides together, which is very nice to see, especially here in this very specific region of Krušné hory. All the involved municipalities and regions have been very active and cooperative.
Among the specific 22 proposed UNESCO sites is the so-called Red Tower of Death near the Czech town of Jáchymov. The 7-story red brick building served as the central sorting plant for uranium ore extracted for shipment to the Soviet Union in the 1950s. The discovery of uranium in the year 1789 had led to the opening of the mine on the Czech side of the border, to which the Communist Party sent hundreds of political prisoners to toil under horrific conditions. On a more pleasant note, many preserved historical town centers are also part of the UNESCO nomination. They include Abertami, Božidar, Horní Blatna, Krupka, and Mědenec on the Czech side, and Freiburg in Germany, the very first town established in the region in the year 1168, when the first silver vein was discovered.
That report by Brian Kennedy. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our main feature. A child survivor of the Holocaust who was interned at Terezín at the tender age of 5, Věra Egermeyer could be forgiven for wanting to forget the past. Instead, like so many other Holocaust survivors, she has devoted a great deal of her time to sharing her story in order to make sure that the tragic lessons of World War II are kept alive for future generations. When she last spoke to Radio Prague in 2013 from her home in New Zealand, she had a dream to build a memorial honouring the 1.5 million children killed during the Holocaust. That dream has since come true, and Věra visited Radio Prague's studio recently to share her feelings.
First, let me say it was not just my dream. There's a whole team of people. There are children, there are teachers. There are members of the Holocaust Center of the Jewish community who had the same dream. And it is beyond, what has happened is beyond my expectations.
You actually and the whole team started the endeavour by collecting 1.5 million buttons, one button for each child. Was that to make the project more engaging for children?
Yes, absolutely. The project itself was started by a teacher in a small Jewish school. And she wanted to give children, there were about 20 children in her class, some idea of the enormity of that disaster. So she thought of collecting buttons. And in fact, those children, that handful of children, who of course are now adults, and who also had that dream, which came but with some time delay, she started them collecting buttons. They touched the buttons, they had to count the buttons. In fact, sometimes it became a little bit of a bore, the ritual of counting. Imagine counting 1.5 million. But the whole idea was to get them involved and to get them thinking about children like them who'd lost their lives. So it started in a school with a teacher, and then the adults became involved.
So one button for each child.
Yes, one button for each child, yes. And the buttons are very different from each other, as all the children were. But the buttons should not really be sacred. I mean, they're just symbols of lives. And the main purpose was to get the children and adults to think about the lost potential, the cut-off lives, to learn the history as well.
And who gave you these buttons? Who did you get them from?
Yes, they came from all over the world. They came from people in New Zealand. They came from many people who I contacted directly in Europe, you know, well-known people. From the Czech Republic, we had a survivor, well-known survivor, Dagmar Lieblova, who gave buttons from the Terezin Initiative for her family. We have Chava Pressburger in Israel, so from all over the world and from prominent people in New Zealand, simple people, people who were touched by the story and who had some perhaps connection themselves with World War II. So many, many sources. And the children had to write letters to get these buttons in, count them. There'd be whole teams of, you know, counting buttons and storing them and so on. So it was a very long project, the button project.
How did schools respond to it?
Yes, it was not directly with schools at that point. You see, we didn't know where to put the buttons, really. That was the problem. There was a difference in vision. Some people in the Jewish community and in the Holocaust Center felt the buttons should be kept in a Holocaust Center. Others felt they should go out into the world. Perhaps in Wellington, the capital of New Zealand, where these the button collection started, in a public space, perhaps on the waterfront in Wellington, perhaps in the botanical garden. But nobody wanted the buttons permanently, so we had to store them. And, of course, they deteriorated, they had to be cleaned and so on. So they did come from everywhere, and the storage was a problem for some time.
There was this question about whether it should be something like a travelling exhibition
that
or whether
came,
it should be a permanent...
That genial solution came when finally the end of the storage period came. We could no longer keep them in the basement of the Holocaust Centre. Whilst they were there, they were still accessible and children would come down and look at the baskets full of buttons, run their fingers through it. But that period came to an end, so someone, and I was not that person, came up with the idea of having a travelling memorial. And that's where a designer came in, and he has designed the memorial so that it can be moved from place to place. And initially it will go all around New Zealand. It's in Wellington and Auckland. It will go south, Christchurch. But that idea developed out of necessity. No home for the buttons. Can't stay in the Holocaust Center. No one else wants them permanently. So the idea of a moving or transportable memorial arose. It was a compromise, but a genial one, because now it's everywhere, not just in one place.
Can you give us some idea of what the memorial looks like?
Yes.
What design you chose and why?
Yes, it was the designer himself, who is Dutch in origin, who's very sensitive to the World War II history, since it touches his own family to some extent. He thought of it in terms of a set of tables, like a nest of tables that fit into each other, showing the interrelationship between us all. So it's like a cascade. People see it differently. It can be like a fountain, a cascade, but basically it's a set of tables that collapse into each other. So when the whole thing is in, you know, one small space, it can be like a tower. But when it's spread out, it can be like a river, it can be like a train. It depends on your imagination. And the buttons are visible all the time because...
Through glass.
They're glass. It's like a set of drawers, if you like. And the advantage is that it can be fitted into many different places, spaces. And it's organic in a way. I mean, it's both a memorial that travels around and also that changes its form in the traveling.
You yourself are a child survivor, we should say, and you have spent much of your life trying to help children understand the enormity of the 1.5 million children's lives lost and the tragedy of the Second World War. Is it difficult in the present day and age to help young children understand what happened, and you know, how do you expose young children to that kind of information?
Well, the best way, and that's sort of used now in Holocaust teaching, is to tell a story. So you tell the story of one child, for example, and that is the way young children understand. And when they think of that another young child like them being projected into a mass of 1.5 million, I think they do understand. And of course, children, like all of us, are now subject or able to see suffering in many forms, television, films, and so on. So young children, even young children, can appreciate suffering. But the buttons were a very, very good way of, you know, presenting it and telling the story of, you know, there are many, many Czech children who lie in these buttons. My own cousin, murdered at 14, Peter Ginz, Hannah and the suitcase. So telling a story. And this is what has been done in this children's book written by a New Zealand author. So it is...
Tell us a bit about the book.
Yes, well, it's the book is a byproduct, really, of the memorial. First we had buttons. First we had a teacher who got children to collect. Then we had the buttons stored, still talking about, you know, the stories lying within them. And then the memorial itself, and on the basis of the memorial, a book was written. This is a book for children between the ages of 5 and 7. The English is simple, and it's words are repeated, so the children, it's a reading exercise as well. And it's an upbeat book. It's not a book about suffering. It's more a book about hope. What kind of values should children have? How to look at the world, you know, to recognize that other people are like them. And it's a very positive message, and the book is very colorful. It's a bright book. It cheers you up. It doesn't pull you down. That's a way of conveying something to children.
And have you seen children visiting this memorial?
Yes,
how do they react
yes. So,
to the buttons and, you know,
yeah,
the system
at the moment,
of drawers?
The memorial is set up in the National Library in Wellington because the project is a Wellington Centre propelled by the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand, which is like a memorial, a museum, if you like, where stories are kept and visitors come. So it is housed in the National Library, and it has several sections. It has a section with the memorial itself set up, this cascade of tables, if you like, nothing around it. That's the way the designer wanted it. And then it has other areas. It's got a reading area. We have books there. Helga Hoshkova-Weissova's book is there. We have Anne Frank's diary, so children can also read. This is so that you get an image of the place where the memorial is housed. Then there's a section on upstanders, trying to get children not to be bystanders, but to do something when they feel something, to behave decently. This is what Nicholas Winton, who is, by the way, a patron of this project, this is what he tried to instill in people. So imagine this space, reading area, upstanders area, and the memorial itself, and that space has been visited by thousands of people. And there is a regular teaching program around the memorial. We have educators who have trained in Yad Vashem who tell stories, their own stories. They usually, I'm one of the few, and there are others who can tell their own story. Usually they tell the story of a relative, you know. So there are many, many children, and I have addressed groups in that space myself who come and who are touched, but you don't want people crying. That's not what it's about. It's to instill good behavior, really, to be a decent person, be a decent child, be a decent friend. Pick the rubbish up if you see it. It has a broader message. And children, I don't know whether that was your question, but they respond very, very well, positively.
Now, your endeavor and this memorial is also a message, a reminder for people, as you say, to behave decently, to stand up to prejudice, discrimination, apathy. Do you feel that you're addressing a very topical issue in the present day?
Well, clearly, there is a lot of apathy in the world today. There's a lot of violence in the world, and people have to make that connection themselves. They see it in their daily lives. I mean, I was shocked just recently in Prague by two events. One was the vandalization of a memorial in the railway station to the parents of the children who Nicholas Winton, the patron of the project and a friend of mine, to those parents who gave up their children. Someone vandalized that. They were not caught on the camera because there was no camera there. So that's a very troubling event that has crept into this country, which has been reasonably peaceful. And the other event that I heard on the news was a young boy of 16 threatening classmates with a firearm. So those are very troubling events on our doorstep here, just as, of course, in New Zealand, the massacre of the Muslim community at prayer in a mosque in Christchurch was a wake-up call for New Zealand. So it is, evil is abroad. It is abroad all the time. And we have to reflect on what happened in the past and somehow adjust our behavior, whatever. I mean, it can be daily behavior. We don't have to be politicians. We can just be normal people who behave in a kind and decent way. So it is a warning that we're not safe anywhere.
Has this project, in fact, working with children, has it helped you to come to terms with what happened on a personal level?
Yes, some people say they work on the Button Project because they could imagine themselves being a button and that they were spared. I don't quite have that because that is actually one way of looking at my story. I was in Terezin as a five-year-old child, right at the end of the war, the last transport after the liberation of Auschwitz and so on. So I could say to myself how lucky that I didn't end up as a button. But what I really reflect on is kind of the dilemmas, the relationships around this whole evil, you know, what my parents had to decide. My mother had to decide to be separated from me at one point. My parents married, when the occupation of Czechoslovakia occurred. So I'm looking for an understanding, really, of my own life. And I hope to give something back in my daily life. So that is what the buttons have brought me. It's not a lot of tears and a lot of trauma. It's more trying to see what it means for me and for us and what I can do with that knowledge.
Vera, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming to the studio and thank you for your good work and sharing all this with others.
Yes, and I'll just add one thing that I would very much, because of my two loyalties to, or my background to Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, and to New Zealand, where we emigrated when I was an 8-year-old child, and my European life, if you wish. I would really like this memorial to come one day, to travel here one day across the ocean and be part of the new memorial in Bubni. And I'm currently working on that with people who are in charge. I can see it being really an integral part of Bubni, which is being created. Thank you.
Let's hope it happens. Thank you very much, Vera. Thank you. That was Vera Eggermeyer speaking about a memorial to the 1.5 million children killed in the Holocaust. And I'm afraid it brings us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. And of course, you can follow Radio Prague on Facebook and Twitter. This is Danielle Zarovar saying thanks for listening and take care.